We will talk about sex this hour and sexual politics with a guest who says sex is in crisis. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, July the 28th. On one hand, our guest says we are drowning in a daily dose of sexual imagery and information due to cable TV, internet porn, the sexual tone of men and women's magazines, and more. But on the other hand, she says we are consumed with doubts about our sex drives, our self-image, and our fears of sexually transmitted diseases. She says the Christian right is largely to blame for that. It has corrupted the national conversation on sex and, she says, is reversing the gains made by the sexual revolution. So, we welcome your thoughts and questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Dagmar Herzog, professor of history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She is the author of Sex After Fascism and the just-published Sex in Crisis, The New Sexual Revolution and the Future of American Politics. And she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Now, there was the sexual revolution of the 60s, but then you say there was another one that started in the early 90s?
That's right. I used to study German history, Jewish-Christian relations, and 19th and 20th century, especially Nazism and the Holocaust, and I looked at how the Nazis associated Jews with dirty sex while offering their own followers clean and spectacular sex, and I never expected to be studying the United States in the last few years, but the culture was changing so rapidly right around the turn of the millennium, and I wanted to understand how that had happened, and how liberals had gotten so defensive that they were unable to defend sexual rights. So my starting puzzle was really this confusion over why Democrats were permitting abstinence education, why they were permitting the restrictions on condoms in President Bush's plan for combating HIV overseas, and just why the conversation had tipped so dramatically that liberals were the ones who were tongue-tied and insecure, and conservatives were doing all the talking and setting the terms.
Yeah, and what prompted this new sexual revolution in the early 90s?
The religious right really came to power on the national stage and in state legislatures and in the party committee, state party, Republican Party, everywhere around the country, through doing the religious right sort of did the sex work for the Republican Party, and they used sex, especially initially homophobia. They targeted a sexual minority and treated homosexuals as though they were objects of fear and loathing. And that worked unbelievably effectively all through the 90s. And probably the last high watermark of that was the re-election of George W. Bush and the anti-gay marriage referenda in 11 states that accompanied that in 2004. It's sort of running aground now. But all through the 90s, mobilizing against homosexuality was the major fundraising tool. And no one could have guessed at that point that they would go after the heterosexual majority as well. Nobody would have put up with it. So one of my organizing questions was what had tipped in around the year 2000 that allowed them to also do an assault on adolescent sexuality and on marital sex?
Yeah, well, what did?
It's a complicated conjunction of circumstances. I mean, partially it's Bush winning. It's unbelievable what a little bit of power will do or what a lot of power will do. They poured $1 billion into abstinence education domestically, to say nothing of what's going on internationally. But beyond that, Viagra was unexpectedly discovered in 1998. It's a wonderful drug. It's helped millions of couples. But it also had a weird side effect, two weird side effects. One is that it raised a strange little puzzle, which is it the drug turning the man on or the woman that's in bed with him? It created a kind of anxiety about the nature of desire. And secondarily, and hugely important, is that it spawned a whole other search for the so-called pink Viagra, for desire and arousal-stimulating substances for women. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies would like to reach the other half of the human race. It's a big market niche. And they've been heavily promoting the idea that women should be dissatisfied with the sex they're having. If they're having little feeble blips or so-called muffle or fizzled orgasms, then they would like to have better ones, please. Or if they're not into sex at all, maybe they could have some testosterone or apomorphine that would either help with desire or arousal. So there's the ever-helpful women's magazine industry and health reporters have been busily out there promoting the news that sex could be better. And interestingly, the religious right, extremely sophisticated, has outwitted the liberals and inserted itself in these elemental anxieties about postmarital sex.
Yeah, you say that they've actually started a sort of a Christian porn industry. What do you mean?
Yeah, it's been a very depressing 2.5 years researching this. I had to read every imaginable bit of evangelical sex advice, and it's mind-blowingly insidious and manipulative and depressing to read. There have been, since the year 2000, 3 million anti-masturbation books sold, and these are not so much directed at young men or women, but at married men. And the whole idea is to try to get men off of porn and entered their wives again. I mean, who would want to be wanted under these circumstances is beyond me, but these books are filled with softcore porn scenarios, even as their overt message is that masturbation destroys the ability to love, and that they claim they are retraining men's minds away from pornography and back onto their wives.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that porn use is something that is intimate and personal for an individual and or for a couple. And yes, it can cause pain in some individual relationships if there is a difference of opinion around that. But to recommend that men learn to bounce their eyes the way you or I would yank our hand off a hot stove, bounce their eyes when they see a pretty woman, and learn not to want junk sex but only want their wives, because, quote, that's the only food left in the cupboard, is already, I think, demeaning to both women and men. And moreover, frighteningly, these books also recommend that wives can help by making themselves available for quickies, even when they're not in the mood themselves, because then their husbands will desire them more. So the whole thing claims to be, the religious right has been unbelievably successful in a whole range of ways in seeming to be appropriating elements of feminism, like they now argue against sex trafficking. Republican senators are all over that one. They're very concerned about domestic abuse, and that's a good thing. I'm glad. But they also now have taken up many women's discomfort with men's interest in porn, but they're manipulating it in such a way that they're arguing that women should make themselves available in order to redirect their husband's attention. They literally say that when a husband is going cold turkey off porn, quote, be like a merciful vial of methadone for him.
Mm. Now, why do you title this Sex in Crisis? Why is sex in crisis?
Because we're living through a war and we don't even notice it. We're living through a war on condoms, both domestically and internationally, right? I mean, a huge number of the high school sex education curricula are no longer allowed to even mention condoms except in regard to failure rates. We're living through a war on the moral concept of consent, which I consider the most important moral concept in the realm of sexuality. It's now, if you read all the Christian sex advice, conservative Christian sex advice that's out there, they constantly lump together child abuse with homosexuality. They lump together rape with premarital consensual sex. They lump together prostitution, which is voluntary, with sex trafficking, which is slavery. They're constantly eroding the notion of consent because they're so busy trying to create the demarcation line of marriage. I think that's scary. And I am especially frightened that Democrats have been unable to fight back. Yeah. So Democrats, for example, in 2007, even though they'd won the Congress back in 06, continue to fund abstinence education. And abstinence education isn't just withholding information from children. It is actually actively lying to them. It's frightening to know what's in these curricula. They literally say that premarital sexual activity will cause depression and suicide. That was a federal mandate in 2006. That's a lie. And it hurts girls in particular.
Yeah. We are, in fact, I was just going to, we still find these PSAs all over the TV for abstinence-only education.
Promise yourself that all good things come to those who wait. That the price of virtue and self-respect is priceless. That real love deserves to be cherished and honored. Promise yourself that by waiting to have sex until you're married, your commitment and relationship will be stronger, more lasting. Promise yourself that abstinence until marriage is worth waiting for.
Yeah, and why do you think, Dagmar Herzog, that's a harmful message?
Well, it comes in the guise of being helpful. It's really interesting that the message works by claiming that the marriages will be, quote, stronger and more lasting. The whole premise of the abstinence argument is that you'll have a happier, more passionate, lastingly passionate marriage if you stay abstinent beforehand. But that's a lie. And 10 years ago, most Americans were in favor of premarital sex. Actually, 95% of Americans have had premarital sex, and most know when they think clearly about it that it's made their own marriages happier. When women have sexual self-ownership, and then they tend to be happier within marriage as well. And the point also is that human beings are different, and what works for one person, some people manage to fall in love with their first love and stay in love forever, but the vast majority don't. And when you start from a false premise, then you're hurting a lot of other people and you're reintroducing a culture of shame.
Our guest is Dagmar Herzog, a professor of history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, author of the new book, Sex in Crisis, The New Sexual Revolution and the Future of American Politics, who says the religious right has gained control of today's sexual politics and the achievements of the sexual revolution have been erased. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We wonder what you think. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Me, honey, gonna set my soul, gonna set my soul on fire. At the end of the day, I'm not a guy who's straight, 'cause she's my heart's desire. Now this lonesome toad is sick of the road. I can't wait,
can't wait,
I can't wait to go home.
Viva!
We're talking about Viagra and other elements of Sex in Crisis. That's the name of our guest's book, Sex in Crisis. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm wondering, Professor Herzog, when you mentioned that the discovery of Viagra had a lot to do with this new sexual revolution, talk more about that. What did Viagra do?
Well, it's actually not Viagra itself, which, like I said, is a wonderful thing for most people. It's who've had either cause to use it themselves or cause to have their partner use it. The issue is what happened as an aftermath. And the interesting thing is that in the year 1994, the first serious study of American sexual attitudes and practices since the Kinsey reports was published by four scholars at the University of Chicago. They did a very careful representative sample of Americans, and what they discovered is that 31% of men and 43% of women in their sample had had some kind of sexual dysfunction in the prior year. That means, you know, some difficulty orgasming for the women, or some erectile difficulties, or premature ejaculation for the men. These were just sort of minor things. They were published in 94, but nobody paid them any mind. Because in 1994, when this book hit the media, it was called Sex in America, and it got, you know, Time magazine cover story, the big news is that Americans were happy. Once a week, marital sex, peanut butter and jelly, ordinary sex was making them perfectly content. People were basically faithful. People were basically happy with just a few sexual practices. They were not too worked up about anything. That was the big news. Americans are happy with monogamy. And what's really, really interesting is that then on the other side of Viagra, so 94 this book is published, everybody's fine. 98 Viagra is discovered. Suddenly, 99, one of the authors together with now others, funded by Pfizer, right, the ones who make Viagra, revisited those old numbers and tried to figure out more about the sexual dysfunction. They ran the factors differently, and they discovered that the ones who'd had some sexual dysfunction typically had lower levels of education or were in poorer overall health. In other words, signs of poverty. It makes complete sense that stressed out lives or poor health lives would have difficulty sexually as well. But that was all suppressed. Within 1 year, 2000, 2001, 2002, the news media, mainstream, respectable media, Newsweek, New York Times, et cetera, Science magazine, as well as a whole bunch of, you know, popular men's and women's magazines, all took up these numbers, 31 and 43%, and suddenly they were morphed into the diagnosis of a national condition. Suddenly, oh my God, 43% of Americans, women, are sexually unhappy. They could have an improvement in their sex lives. It was treated as a women's rights agenda to suddenly find drugs to address that. Half the women in America have trouble enjoying sex. The numbers are like getting gently rounded up. There was hysteria about this. Meanwhile, there's one other little number that suddenly popped into the news, which also came out of this study. They had found that 1 in 6 men and 1 in 3 women had little or no desire for sex at all in their study back. The research had been done in 92, and no one had cared. And suddenly, in the year 2003, you can go back and look at this, the New York Times and every single, you know, major thing, USA Today, et cetera, they're all publishing the news that people don't want sex anymore. It's the death of desire in America. And often it's the men who don't want sex. Even Cosmo was telling its much younger readers what to do, quote, when his sex drive takes a nosedive. Mm-hmm. There was a spasm about the death of desire, also in men. And a whole bunch of books started getting published, like Resurrecting Sex, In the Mood Again, what was the other one? The Sex-Starved Marriage. There was an enormous concern that people were not having postmarital sex. And whether or not this is true is not the interesting question. The interesting question is how those fears were manipulated. It's that insecurity about the death of desire that that little girl in the PSA is addressing, right? Mm-hmm. The reason liberals are so intimidated is because what do you say when somebody says, oh, you're not having postmarital sex anymore? What are you supposed to say? Yes, it's true, or no, it's not? Liberals have gotten completely tongue-tied. They're not able to say, wait a minute, there's nothing wrong with sex. It's okay for people to have it. They don't have to be married. That's become politically suicidal to say in the United States.
Well, and you say it's the Christian right that manipulated this.
Right, but it's in conjunction with women's advice culture, in conjunction with pharmaceutical companies, right? It's a lot of things that come together. And frankly, it's in conjunction with the collaboration of the intimidated liberals who can't get their mouths open and say sexual rights are human rights, period.
Yeah. Well, why
get your nose out of my bedroom. I mean, how hard is that to say?
And I don't know, but why do you think liberals can't say that?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, they're intimidated around a whole bunch of things, whether it's the war in Iraq or the economy, you know, obviously, or wiretapping of American citizens. Generally, we're experiencing democracy in crisis as well, right? Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party in crisis, despite the fact that you would think it would be poised to be winning these days. Obviously, we've got a problem that's larger than sex. But sex is something pretty important to human beings, and it's something that the religious right has worked unbelievably effectively all through the 90s and all through the last 8 years as well. It's been a way to keep people worked up and foaming at the mouth and luridly fascinated with other people and restricting other people's rights. The Bush government just in the last few days has announced that it wants to now incorporate IUDs and emergency contraception into the definition of abortion. It's like a little rule change within the Department of Health and Human Services. These things have consequences, and if people don't speak up, it's going to go into place.
Andre in Wauwatosa emails this: sexuality is an absolute right of choice. It should never be dictated by a mass movement like the Christian right. This religious undertaking is a psychological war on the freedom of all human beings. Do you want to react to that?
I do, and I'm really glad that Andre said it's a psychological war, because one of the biggest take-home messages of my book, and one of the things I stumbled into in the course of the research, and I thought, oh my God, this is how it's working. Now I understand, is the paradoxical point that the religious right succeeded by secularizing. It succeeded not only by fomenting fears of physical disease, sexually transmitted diseases, which they wildly exaggerate and lump all the diseases together and act like you can't treat or cure any of them, but beyond that, they succeeded above all by taking over the terrain of psychological health. This is a brilliant point that Andre is making. They succeeded by making issues of sexuality, issues of self-esteem, so that this little girl in the PSA that you played is saying, it's worth the wait, right? And the whole idea is, I am worth the wait. If I value myself, then I will not be having sex. They're constantly saying that virgins have better life outcomes. This is absolute nonsense. And yet, of course, it makes people terribly vulnerable to hear that they will do better in sports or better in academics if they desist from sexual activity, or that they'll have a hotter, happier marriage if they desist from sexual activity before marriage.
Yeah. When you say they overstate, the religious right overstates the danger of STDs, how so?
Well, it's everywhere you look, any kind of abstinence website, and there are many, also ones that are government-sponsored. You can, for example, take a look at the Florida Department of Health. It's a particularly egregious as an example. But all of them, also the private ones, and their kinds of views are also used then in federally funded sex education in high schools across the country. They argue that, oh my God, you know, so-and-so many girls have chlamydia and so-and-so many girls have, you know, HPV, which can lead to cervical cancer and genital warts. And what they're doing is neglecting to point out that chlamydia can be treated. They're neglecting to point out that HPV, human papillomavirus, can now be guarded against with a vaccine. They're neglecting to point out that those who already have it, the vast majority of strains do not cause any problems. Only a few of the dozens of strains, actually four to be precise, cause either genital warts or cervical cancer. So they're basically lumping together different diseases. They'll talk about fatal diseases when only, you know, cervical cancer, of course, can be fatal. But the other thing that can be fatal is HIV, but they're lumping all of this together. And at the same time, they are denigrating the value of condoms. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are living through a war on condoms, and it is terrifying to me. This little bit of latex is a beautiful thing. It can prevent the vast majority of diseases if when used correctly. And what should be promoted is correct and consistent use. What should be promoted is a way of making condoms seem erotic and loving. That's what pro-sex rights advocates were doing in the 90s, and that's what's now been made impossible by the assaults of the religious right.
Our guest is Dagmar Herzog, author of Sex in Crisis. Our next caller is Kathleen in Green Bay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dagmar. I want to just applaud your work, because what we are hearing from the right is wrong. I look at sexuality as a continuum also to include gay and lesbian people, and the diversity in the continuum of sexuality is huge. And as you mentioned before, I believe the gay community has been targeted. A group which I'm probably sure you're familiar with, if you aren't, would be in your best interest to look them up, but Exodus International.
Of course.
And they believe if you embrace Jesus, you can become ungay.
Right.
And it's interesting how you said they do link AIDS to gays and they link pedophiles to gays.
Of course.
And that's awful. But my point that I wanted to just throw out to you as a thought for this cauterization of the right is, do you think since the Berlin Wall came down, when communism was the threat to cauterize these right-wing formalized religious churches, if you would call them that, do you think that now that is no longer a threat, that they had to have something else to go for? And what you're saying as sexuality and going after the gay community is something that has now cauterized their people?
Okay, I have about three different things to say to your incredibly interesting and important comment. One is that sexuality has always been an easy way to manipulate people politically, right? I mean, this is why I studied the Nazis and the ways in which they used sex to manipulate people, basically preventing some people from having sex and whipping up punitive affect towards homosexuals and Jews, and on the other hand, of course, promising their own followers wildly ecstatic orgasmic sex. I mean, there is a similarity here. You cannot win a movement by simply being repressive and sexually conservative. You have to promise pleasure, and it's important to notice that the religious right promises its own followers multiply orgasmic, fabulous sex within marriage for decades. And absolutely, they exclude homosexuals. And as recently as 2005, for example, a conservative parents group, and you have to notice that even though things are falling apart at the national level in terms of homophobia, locally it continues. These wars are going on everywhere, every little community. They are trying to fight for what's going on in the sex education curriculum and whether you can even mention homosexuality, and if so, in what terms. And in 2005, a parents group, conservative parents group, actually won a lawsuit against a sex education curriculum that said that homosexuality was natural and benign. And they insisted that the notion of gay bowel disease, which of course does not exist, be introduced. They're trying to make the physical health argument why we have to tell students that there's something dangerous, as though only homosexuals engage in anal sex and not heterosexuals as well, right? It's absurd. And they whined that their own children would be subjected to religious discrimination if they expressed their homophobic views. So there is an unbelievable ugliness and this willingness constantly to generate contempt for homosexuals. The interesting thing about Exodus is that Exodus has existed for a long time, since the 70s, and they claim that they can convert gays to straights. Now, that may work for a tiny percent of people only because many people are bisexual by nature, so of course they're able to be converted with a lot of effort and shaming. But the interesting point, of course, is that the former leaders of Exodus now have fallen in love with each other. and say it's homophobia with a happy face, and they've gotten out, and they think it's disgusting. But some people still find it beneficial and struggle with their desires because human beings are complicated, and many people have same-sex desires within themselves. So it can always speak to many different people and manipulate them while fomenting hatred in the guise of love.
Well, please keep up the great work that you're doing, and I think that you are absolutely right on about the wrong of the right. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. Remember this guy, Ted Haggard, pastor of the New Life Church in Colorado.
Hi, right. My name is Ted Haggard. I pastor New Life Church in Colorado Springs, and of course, people want to know, how do you have a good family? It is not hard. It is easy. First of all, you find a person of the opposite sex, and you make a lifelong commitment to them.
Yeah, and then wasn't he involved in a... He was involved in a scandal involving going to a
male prostitute, and he also had a thing for methamphetamines. That's right.
Yeah.
And now, of course, he's been cleaned up by James Dobson and a few other people and deemed to be completely heterosexual, and that whatever that means, there is no such thing as homo or heterosexual. There are preferences and trajectories within people's lives, but the whole division is a very recent concept and, again, one of those things that the religious right manipulates. The thing that I would point to about the Ted Haggard scandal that's, to me, incredibly important has to do with the elections, the midterm elections of 2006. The Democrats won those, squeaking by with a teensy majority for a few reasons. One is that the war in Iraq was going very badly and Americans were getting disillusioned. But another is that a number of the Democrats running were themselves anti-abortion, and that confused categories. So that's another sign of liberals absorbing conservative attitudes. And another thing that happened were these scandals. First, Mark Foley, the senator in Florida, who was doing inappropriate text messaging with male interns. And then the Haggard scandal. And suddenly the religious right was exposed as being the hypocrites that they are. And that made them, it really tipped and caused a number of people to be disillusioned very quickly right around the time of the election. And it was striking to me that a number of religious right leaders, right in the aftermath of losing that election, suddenly we're saying, well, we really should recall ourselves to spiritual issues. Maybe we should stop being involved in politics. Maybe it's time to rethink what the Bible is asking of us. And what became apparent, of course, is that all of this is about power. They ride these sexual hobby horses as long as they can because it works, because you can get people riled up that way. And the minute it stops working, they're like, oh, right, Jesus is more concerned with justice for the poor. And I'm grateful when they realize that. That's a plus. But it's also quite striking that so much has to do with the dream of political power.
Rich and Sullivan is with us now. Hi, Rich.
Hi. First, congratulations and thank you for the bravery of the guest you have on this morning, because it's a difficult issue in America. The Puritans truly came here, and I think the tipping point for me was when those who call themselves anti-abortion, or whom I think of as basically anti-choice, became anti-contraceptive.
Right.
And if you're anti-abortion, you would want contraceptives everywhere. There are also other associated issues that kind of revolve around this sort of yuck factor that Americans seem to think of when they think of Woody Allen's quip, is sex dirty? Well, yes, it is if you're doing it right, which is a joke,
mm-hmm.
but breastfeeding is looked upon in American society as an indecent exposure act, when it's the most natural kind of relationship between a woman and an infant. And also, even Sam Nunn now, who at the time of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, being instituted in the United States military, even Sam Nunn has come around in recent hearings and interviews to say, you know, this policy about prohibiting gay people in the military is an anomaly, because around the world, brave young men and women serve in the military in Israel and England and other places, and their sexuality is sexuality that would not be considered, quotes, normal in America. So to end this call, thank you so very much for writing these books and for also doing these interviews, because it's time for people to start thinking clearly about a wide variety of sexual issues.
Well, thanks for calling, Rich.
That's very nice. Can I just say something about the anti-abortion forces now exposing themselves as anti-contraception?
Yes.
I mean, that's an incredibly important point. We cannot stress that enough. It's incredible to me how long Democrats have been intimidated by the anti-abortion forces and have just had this tepid little defense of contraceptives in response. What they should say is, if it's really about life, as opposed to controlling female sexuality, which is the obvious subtext once you realize that they're now going after contraceptives as well, then what we need to do is have a lot more open discussion in high schools about mutual masturbation. It's a great way not to get pregnant. We should have a lot more discussion about dildos and other sex toys.
Right.
We should have a lot more discussion of condoms,
yeah.
Right? I mean, if it were really about life, about, oh, my God, we just cannot let that sperm get to that egg, then think about all the sexual practices that should be being celebrated and promoted. And that's not being openly enough said. That's where the tongue-tied problem is coming in.
Yeah, well, when someone does say something along those lines, like Joycelyn Elders, the
right.
former Surgeon General, she's fired.
Forced to step down in an outcry. But see, the point is that at that moment, Democrats should have stood up. And in fact, sex shouldn't be a left-right issue at all. Republicans should stand up and say, we want our daughters to be happy. We want our sons to be happy. We want people not to be ashamed. And the interesting thing about abortion as well, and you can research this, and what's in my book, is that evangelicals were not uniformly opposed to it when Roe versus Wade first happened in 73. That was something that gathered steam over time. The religious right, in other words, the politicization of evangelical Protestantism, occurred out of racism, not out of anti-abortion sentiment. And that's important to understand, that initially it had to do with the tax-exempt status of Christian colleges because they barred black students and barred interracial dating. And that's what initially politicized the evangelicals into becoming what's now the religious right. And then they realized that you can work people up around abortion and confuse people, and you can work people up around homosexuality.
We're talking with Dagmar Herzog, a professor of history at the City University of New York, author of the new book, Sex in Crisis, The New Sexual Revolution and the Future of American Politics. 1-800-642-1234, our number, if you would like to join in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn. Join Veronica and her guest for All Things Political, with all the talk of everything that happened politically last week, All Things Political after 9 o'clock. We're talking about sexual politics during this hour with the author of the book Sex in Crisis, The New Sexual Revolution and the Future of American Politics, Dagmar Herzog. And remember, not so long ago, John McCain was asked by a reporter why he voted for the funding insurance coverage of Viagra and not for birth control, which led to this somewhat uncomfortable exchange.
I guess her statement was that it was unfair that health insurance companies cover Viagra but not birth control. Do you have an opinion on that?
Know enough about it to give you a informed answer, because I don't recall the vote. I have cast thousands of votes in the Senate, but I will respond to you. It's a choice. It's something that I had not thought much about, and I did hear about her response, but I hadn't thought much. But I will get back to you today on it. I don't usually duck an issue, but I try to get back to you.
Well, I'm not sure what he did say when he got back to her on that, but you want to talk a little bit, Professor Herzog, about insurance coverage of Viagra and not birth control?
Yeah, well, there's a number of things to say about McCain and this issue. First of all, back in, 2008. It's been this year. It's end of 2007, beginning of 2008. Reporters were asking all the Republican candidates, how they felt about the distribution of condoms as part of President Bush's PEPFAR plan in Africa. And Huckabee was actually, interestingly, although he's the evangelical, pretty balanced. You know, he definitely had the religious right argument that you don't want to encourage promiscuity, but, you know, condoms might be a good idea. McCain was much worse, and he said, so asked by a reporter whether condoms helped to stop the spread of HIV, McCain said, quote, "You've stumped me. I'm not informed enough on it."
Oh, you said that before. Okay.
Yeah, so that was about condoms, and that was about Africa, right? And then he sort of stumbled on. He said, Brian, what's my position on contraception? I'm not sure. I'm sure I'm opposed to government spending. I'm sure I support the president's policies. I've never gotten into these issues before. Right? I mean, the thing about him is that he's a consistent anti-Roe versus Wade person. He's explicitly said he wants to see Roe versus Wade overturned. What's interesting is that he chose Carly Fiorina to run his parts of his campaign, the victory campaign, and she's a good choice because there's some hope that they can carve away some of Hillary Clinton's supporters for the Republican Party. She's a successful businesswoman. She's feisty, and she's the one who made this blooper, trying to give an example for why universal health care coverage, which is what the Democrats want, is somehow socialistic. And really, people should, quote, have a choice. And she just spontaneously volunteered the idea that maybe some women would like to have insurance companies that cover contraception. And it is, of course, egregious that insurance companies cover Viagra but not contraception. I mean, why is it that men have the right to sexual self-expression and women do not? Because when women do it with a man as opposed to having lesbian sex, there is always that little pesky problem of maybe getting pregnant. So it's an absolutely smart thing that she brought it up. The trouble was that he was not emotionally prepared. And Judith Warner, writing the New York Times, made a very funny comment because she also, you just played the, you know, audible clip, but she was reading his facial expression when he was confronted by the reporter. And her overwhelming feeling was he just doesn't care. He really just doesn't care at all. Yeah. And overwhelmingly, I would say that that's something that people have just not thought through enough.
Yeah, he certainly looked uncomfortable. James in Minneapolis, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got to say I got a big job to do as far as kind of presenting an opposing view in about 20 seconds. I can't really come with a lot of wisdom of words and you know, cover very many bases very quickly, but I think the bottom point is whether or not a person has faith in God and how God created everything, the body, our social systems, you know, and just how far we're moving away from that faith. And it really moves into all this stuff. And I like people just to remember, you know, she made a comment that, you know, we should start teaching our children in our government-instituted educational systems about mutual masturbation, you know, probably oral sex and these different things like that. We're going to be brought up and taught either one thing or another, you know. And I don't think that the majority of people would be willing to say that, yeah, we think that, you know, children should be practicing these sexual things, you know, on each other and all the problems that this will cause, you know, diseases, premarital pregnancies. You know, we've experienced 50 million abortions since the sexual revolution took hold and just all that stuff. And like I said, it's a big job to do to try to, you know, present an opposing side, but no, I wholeheartedly disagree with everything that you're
Hold on. You have more than 20 seconds. No one gives you 20 seconds, but let's just on the general question there or contention that you know, that we don't need our government-sponsored educational systems teaching young kids about mutual masturbation and the like. That's not the place for something like that to happen.
I don't think it's about teaching kids how to have oral sex. I think it's about our obligation, whether as Christians or not, people of faith or not, of whatever religion, to not lie to our children. And when we tell our children that premarital sexual contact of any kind will lead to depression and suicide, that it will ruin the chance of marital happiness, that it will ruin marital sex, then we are lying, and that's not a Christian thing. God made us, that's right. That's one way many people think. The majority of people in this country believe that. But 95% of the people in this country have had premarital sex, and if they think deeply about it, they'll realize that that resource was a plus for them, that it makes their marital sex happier and stronger.
Yeah. And again, Professor Herzog, what is the harm if religious families or religious institutions want to try to encourage their members or anyone else for that matter to, you know, to not have sex outside of marriage?
The most important thing we can do for our children is to model happiness and to create an atmosphere of trust. So lying doesn't help.
Yeah. James, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I have a whole bunch, but I don't think it's worth getting into it other than the
James,
fact
can I just say something to you? Listen, I mean, married women, they need condoms. Married women, they need contraceptives. Married women, they need loving husbands who know what they're doing. Basically, you have to think about marital happiness. I'm most concerned about post-marital happiness, and I'm worried that what we're telling people in schools right now is actually damaging their future happiness. So you need to understand that I'm doing this what you might consider a prayerful position.
Yeah, and James has left us. Thank you for the call. Mary in Wausau, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just started as an abstinence educator, and I have always been more for comprehensive education. Until I started reading and until I started this program, and it just goes through, it's an eight-week program that we do for middle schoolers and high schoolers. And it goes through setting different goals, not only for abstinence until marriage, but for something like college, you know, what you want to do after school, sports, anything. And then it goes through things like the media and how different sexual images make kids want to feel, you know, different ways, what sexual abuse is and how to handle relationship abuse, what's good, what's bad, and how to say no, and then just in the end, again, reiterating how you can reach your goals. And so it covers all different areas, not only of abstinence until marriage, but just how to plan for life. And we do go over how it affects you, such as physically with STDs, and we do cover every single STD individually, you know, the different signs, symptoms, how it can be treated, if it can or if it cannot. We also cover condoms and how the rate has increased, and now it's within throughout the 90s and into 2000s, but how it's pretty much leveled off, but how the STD rates have also increased along with the condom use, and it's because so much of the STDs can be transferred through skin-to-skin contact and not just, you know, and so the condom does not prevent that.
Yeah, what about that? Well, hold on. There's so many facts. What about that, Professor Herzog?
I'm familiar with the ways in which the abstinence curricula position themselves as though they're helping people achieve a wider sense of life goals, right? Career achievement, success in college, life planning, and so on. I'm familiar with how they present themselves. The important point is that the understandable revulsion that many young people as well as their parents feel about the media titillation and the understandable revulsion at sort of alcohol-fueled hookup culture and meaningless sex on college campuses, all of that does not need to be responded to with abstinence, and abstinence until marriage especially. I mean, what the feminist movement fought for all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s was the right to say no. As an individual, to be sexually self-determined, to say, no, I don't want to have sex with you, no, I don't want to do that particular practice, no, I don't want to do this now with anybody or not with you. That is very, very different from having a one-size-fits-all recommendation for everybody, which is utterly obnoxious and is utterly destructive of most people's post-marital happiness as well.
Thanks to Mary. Tom in Lake Geneva. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Is it Dr. Herzog?
It is.
Yeah, Doctor, I just wanted to say two things. First is a personal comment. You've been very brilliant and articulate this morning, and that's very sexy. Number two, one of the things I've been really annoyed about is since the religious right has had their influence, it's been okay for a pharmacist to deny a birth control prescription. And I've got some daughters that actually have had trouble getting their prescriptions filled through what would be normal conventional channels, including Planned Parenthood, because there's been a lack of funding available for that support. And a lot of that's all driven by the religious right and this whole concept that, you know, contraception is virtually equivalent to abortion. So I'd like to hear your comments about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just devastates me that your daughters have actually had this kind of experience, and it's incredibly brave for you to even get on the radio and say that, because that's precisely what's wrong in this country, that people feel so intimidated they can't even say, my children are having sex and they're fine. And it's an outrage that someone is denying them contraceptives. So thank you, above all, for your courage. It's true. There are some states in the United States where pharmacists are permitted to not sell contraceptives to unmarried women. And what some state legislatures have now done is to insist that every prescription must be filled and you may not use your conscience exemption clause. And that's precisely what this Department of Health and Human Services maneuver that Bush is doing in the last few days is about. They are trying now to circumvent these new progressive state laws that insist the prescriptions be filled by making a rule change that allows pharmacists and medical clinics to interpret emergency contraception and sometimes even the birth control pill on a routine use basis, and certainly also IUDs, as forms of abortion. It's this kind of subtle, insidious, behind-the-scenes rule change that is precisely the worrisome thing.
Steve in Houston, Texas, hello.
Yeah, hi. Two quick points. I'll try to be brief. I think that every case study that I've read has shown that what your guest is saying is nonsense, and I think the reason is this. You can't put a Band-Aid on the heart and the spirit of a 13-year-old when they have sex. Sex, you know, we are not dogs. As a Christian, you have to realize, I'm sure you'll acknowledge, that we have a spirit. We have a heart and a soul, and the reason that sex with young people is so tragic and has led to such tragedy is that it scars irreplaceably the human heart and soul.
And I'm sorry, Steve, you got your point in there, and we have less than a minute for a final response. Professor Herzog?
I appreciate what you're saying, Steve, but you know what? The vast majority of 13-year-olds are not ready to have sex and don't want to have sex and will not have sex. It's usually what we're talking about is 17, 18, 19-year-olds, and no, they're not dogs, and they should not be treated as dirty or dog-like when they're choosing to have sex in a self-determined way.
Yeah. Do you see what is the future of sexual politics in our final minute? Do you see it changing from what it is now?
Well, I think that the combination of callers that we've had in the show show how divided Americans are and how much passion and pain there is on both sides. It shouldn't be a left-right issue. Everybody should want happiness for their children, but people shouldn't get confused about what that means. If we want to have happier long-term, decades-long, passionate marriages, we have to not lie to our children.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dagmar Herzog is a professor of history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She is the author of Sex After Fascism and the just published Sex in Crisis, The New Sexual Revolution and the Future of American Politics. If you'd like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. Or you can go to our website, wpr.org. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, Rob Ferret, and Cynthia Schuster, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.